From the Moan Broadcast Center, this is Air Talk. Good morning, I'm Larry Mantle. 2 hours ago, Special Counsel Robert Mueller spoke publicly for the first time since launching the Russia investigation. He repeatedly emphasized he has nothing to tell Congress beyond what's in his report. Mueller also pointed out President Trump was not exonerated of obstructing the investigation. The implications of Mueller's comments right after the news. Good morning, it's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Wonderful to have you with us. Coming up, the elevation of so-called authentic restaurants. What does authenticity mean, particularly in this city where we mash up all different cultures into brand new things? But first, former special prosecutor Robert Mueller made a surprise appearance on national TV and radio this morning. It's the first time he's spoken publicly since his team began its investigation into Russian attempts to influence the last presidential election. Speaking from the Department of Justice, Mueller began by recounting the reasons Justice launched the investigation. And he laid it right out, describing the limits on the report's conclusions when it came to the president.
And as set forth in the report, after that investigation, if we had had confidence that the president clearly did not commit a crime, we would have said so. We did not, however, make a determination as to whether the president did commit a crime. The introduction to the Volume 2 of our report explains that decision. It explains that under long-standing department policy, a president cannot be charged with a federal crime while he is in office. That is unconstitutional. Even if the charge is kept under seal and hidden from public view, that too is prohibited. The special counsel's office is part of the Department of Justice, and by regulation, it was bound by that department policy. Charging the president with a crime was therefore not an option we could consider.
Mueller detailed why investigating possible obstruction of justice was still important, despite there being no ability to charge a sitting president.
First, the opinion explicitly permits the investigation of a sitting president because it is important to preserve evidence while memories are fresh and documents available. Among other things, that evidence could be used if there were co-conspirators who could be charged now. And second, the opinion says that the Constitution requires a process other than the criminal justice system to formally accuse a sitting president of wrongdoing. And beyond department policy, we were guided by principles of fairness. It would be unfair to potentially accuse somebody of a crime when there can be no court resolution of the actual charge.
Mueller continued.
So that was Justice Department policy. Those were the principles under which we operated. And from them, we concluded that we would not reach a determination one way or the other about whether the president committed a crime. That is the office's final position. And we will not comment on any other conclusions or hypotheticals about the president.
As he approached his close, the former special counsel made very clear he hoped this morning marked the end of his comments about the investigation.
Now, I hope and expect this to be the only time that I will speak to you in this manner. I am making that decision myself. No one has told me whether I can or should testify or speak further about this matter. There has been discussion about an appearance before Congress. Any testimony from this office would not go beyond our report. It contains our findings and analysis and the reasons for the decisions we made. We chose those words carefully, and the work speaks for itself. And the report is my testimony. I would not provide information beyond that which is already public in any appearance before Congress. In addition, access to our underlying work product is being decided in a process that does not involve our office. So beyond what I've said here today and what is contained in our written work, I do not believe it is appropriate for me to speak further about the investigation or to comment on the actions of the Justice Department or Congress.
The former special counsel, Robert Mueller, spoke for just under 10 minutes, but I think in those four selections, you get the gist of the most important comments that he makes. Joining us to elaborate further, reporter covering the Justice Department for The Wall Street Journal, Aruna Viswanatha. Aruna, thank you for being with us. First of all, how surprising was it that Mueller took to the cameras and microphones this morning at Justice?
Thanks for having me. And yeah, I think that's probably the biggest takeaway here. He was silent for 2 years, and now, after all is said and done, the Justice Department puts out this statement earlier today saying Robert Mueller will make a statement, and that in and of itself was probably the most surprising thing that happened today.
Also, he did mention about approving of the Attorney General, Bill Barr, putting out the nearly full report to Congress with some redactions for national security and grand jury issues and testimony. He didn't take on specifically what some thought was criticism about how Barr characterized the report. Your thoughts on him not directly addressing how the Attorney General spoke of the report?
I think what he was saying to some extent was this is sort of water under the bridge at this point. He said, yes, I did take issue with some things that the Attorney General did at the very beginning, but now that he's put most of the report out to the public, it doesn't really matter at this point, and we appreciate the Attorney General's efforts to make much of the report public.
One of the things that was still unclear to me, and maybe you can elaborate, is he, to paraphrase, said, you can't charge a sitting president regardless of obstruction, regardless of what the evidence shows. And he said, nonetheless, it was important to conduct this because when people's memories are fresh, we get on the record people talking about the activities that were carried out specifically here by the Trump campaign leading up to the 2016 election. I didn't fully understand what the reasoning was for him not saying whether there was, in fact, objectively obstruction of justice, independent of the president's ability to be charged. Do you have any thoughts on that, Aruna?
So this is a pretty nuanced point that he's making, but he's saying that because this longstanding Justice Department policy exists, which says that the president cannot be a sitting president cannot be indicted, he's saying that his office decided that they couldn't go down the road of making a determination of whether the president committed a crime or not because one of those options, yes or no, was not available to them. The yes was not available to them. Yes, he did commit a crime. So they're saying that because going down the road of making a determination might lead them to a determination that he had committed a crime, that would be in conflict with the existing Justice Department policy that prohibited them from indicting a sitting president. So it's a pretty nuanced thing, but he's essentially saying that on the one hand, they couldn't clearly exonerate the president. They said that, but then they also didn't want to go down the road of even trying to make a full determination of what actually whether a crime was committed or not by the president because they didn't want to be in a position of potentially reaching a determination that he had committed a crime.
We're talking with Justice Department reporter for The Wall Street Journal, Aruna Viswanatha, also joining us, Matt Rodriguez, Democratic strategist, and Sean T. Walsh, Republican strategist as well. President Trump, by the way, tweeting after Robert Mueller's statement this morning, nothing changes from the Mueller report. There was insufficient evidence, and therefore in our country, a person is innocent. The case is closed. Thank you. Of course, now we're expecting to hear from Jerry Nadler, who chairs the House Judiciary Committee, to talk later today about what the next actions of the House might well be. Matt, let me ask you, Does anything change from what you heard with Mueller? Any change in what the invitation or pressure is on Congress?
Well, there's a lot of breathless commentary going on now. I was driving in, and it's sort of chaos on the on both sides of the ideological spectrum. I'm not sure a lot changes all that much right now. The problem with this report I've always had is it's become a Rorschach test, right? It's just whatever you want to read into it, you will. And now the same thing is happening with his statement. Basically, they're like, he's completely at odds with Bill Barr. He says, well, he's happy that Bill Barr largely put the report out. If you listen to the commentary, it's now what he's underlying really saying is that he's very unhappy with Bill Barr. And this is, you know, he feels like Congress needs to impeach. I don't know exactly. I would say a couple of things. The first is I do think this is going to ramp up the pressure on Democrats a little bit, simply because it's a very strange statement and standard to say if we could have exonerated him, or if we didn't, you know, if we could have said he didn't commit a crime, we would have. That is going to now create a lot, and you're already
seeing it. It does sound like an invitation, doesn't it?
It does. I mean, it essentially says, it sounds really what it sounds like, because I would have charged him with it. He went through this whole disquisition of why he couldn't charge him with a crime, but that he wasn't going to say that he didn't commit a crime. So you sort of are left with, that sounds like what he's talking about, but it isn't clear enough. And so this is going to end up where it was always going to end up, which is Congress is going to need to make a decision, and Pelosi's going to need to at some point really deal with this. She's put it off for as long as possible. I think she'll get away with it for a little while longer, but not much more.
Matt Rodriguez, Democratic strategist, former senior Obama advisor. Sean T. Walsh, Republican political strategist. Sean, your thoughts about whether anything changes from Mueller's elaboration today?
Well, Matt Rodriguez, once again, is wise like Yoda. I pretty much agree with almost everything he said. The only thing I would...
I have smaller ears, but yes.
Indeed. The only thing I would cleave on is he was... at least given a pass on the collusion with Russia. So that piece in the report is off the table. What you really saw today was if Jerry Nadler or Adam Schiff feels compelled to try and subpoena Mueller into coming to Congress and testifying, basically what he did, in my view, in front of the cameras today was giving his opening statement that he would give to a congressional hearing, and gave his closing statement as well. And he said, basically, anything else you ask me, I'm not going to answer. And if I did have to answer, I'd just point you to the line and the page and the report that I put forward, because my report is my word. So I think in some respects, Mueller inoculated himself and tried to do a brushback pitch to Congress saying, I'm not going to go testify to you, number one. And number two, and most importantly, as we've said on this show all along, or at least I have, the Constitution is pretty clear. The judicial branch does not have the ability to indict and prosecute a sitting president. That is prerogatives left to Congress through the impeachment and conviction process. So, as Matt said, it's in their court.
Mueller made very clear this morning that no one is keeping him from testifying before Congress. He said he was under no directions, under no pressure, but that the report spoke for itself. What do you think likely the chairs of these committees are now going to do, Matt, given, as Sean put it, the brushback pitch?
Yeah, I don't know what they're going to do. I'm not sure this is going to fly with them, because there's just not enough at this press conference. So I understand what he's saying is, I don't want to answer any more questions or my report speaks for itself. Whether the Congress is going to find that sufficient or not, I'm pretty sure they're not going to find that sufficient. Now, whether they're going to take the step of subpoenaing him, especially once he leaves the Justice Department, which I guess could be now, for all intents and purposes.
Yeah, because he announced this morning he's going back into the private sector.
So essentially they could subpoena him. I wonder if Pelosi needs to figure out, and this has been rattling around D.C. for a while, I wonder if they're going to need some kind of select committee, or they're going to have to actually – they're going to need some way to relieve some kind of pressure here. And I think having Schiff with his committee and Nadler and all these – it's kind of becoming – Maxine Waters, it's become a circus. And I think she's going to have to find some way – I don't think the American public holds either Republicans or Democrats in very high regard, but I think they're going to have to try to find some way to kind of funnel all of this information and work into one – either committee or some kind of entity, because I just think right now it's become, everyone is kind of piling on. He needs to give us this. He's not giving us this. This is obstruction. Don McGahn's not testifying to this committee. Someone's not testifying to that committee. We want tax returns here. I think they have to find a way to get a narrative that they can actually move forward if they're going to try to do something here.
Politically, so let's say Democrats believe Mueller really isn't going to elaborate beyond what he is. And by all accounts of the people who know him, he seems to be a pretty disciplined guy. He's certainly been for the last 2 years when it comes to not speaking. So, do Democrats politically get anything out of subpoenaing Mueller. He shows up, says what he said this morning, doesn't go beyond it, says not going to comment beyond mm-hmm. what's in the report. What's the political ramification of that?
Well, there's a risk to that, because if he goes there and doesn't see anything, the challenge anytime you have a PR kind of battle is you always need new information. And I think one of the challenges Democrats have right now is there's not a lot of really new information that's coming out there. There's a lot of new tactics. There's a lot of new, you know, there are events that are happening. But in terms of the new fact pattern, this is what Trump did. Oh, this leads us to believe X or Y. And so Mueller's already spoken, and if he comes to Congress and essentially does the same thing and punts on everything else, it's going to say, well, we already knew this from – there's nothing new here. There's not, you know, there's nothing new to commit to charge the president with a crime or impeachment. And so, yes, there is some risk. There's risk, one, that he ignores it, which makes them look weak in some form. Or there's a risk that he comes there and doesn't do anything new, and people look and say, well, we already
knew
this.
Does it make them look petulant if they keep hammering him with questions that he's been clear he's not going to answer?
That he's not going to answer. And look, this is a political process by definition, so you already have people lining up on both sides of this. So if you're not feeding something new that can move people, it does make you look overtly political in an already political atmosphere.
We'll continue with Matt Rodriguez and Sean Walsh. We're talking about former special counsel Robert Mueller's appearance at the Justice Department this morning, in which he spoke for nearly 10 minutes, describing the results of his team's investigation into Russian efforts to influence the 2016 presidential election, also making clear that he doesn't want to make any further public comments, but let the report speak for itself. We'll be back in 1 minute on Air Talk. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. Larry Mantle with political analyst Sean Walsh and Matt Rodriguez, also from the Wall Street Journal, Justice Department reporter Aruna Vishwanatha. Aruna, let me come back to you. And I know you cover justice, but you have any sense from here what Congress is likely to do in the wake of what Mueller said?
So I think as of now, what we're hearing from Congress is largely in line with what they have been saying over the past few weeks. I think we saw one new Democratic House member call for impeachment hearings, but from Jerry Nadler, chairman of the Judiciary Committee, who would be responsible, has said that he wants to start holding impeachment hearings, but obviously Pelosi has held off at this point. And in a statement she just released a little while ago, she seems to be sort of holding that line, saying, yes, various committees are going to continue to investigate the president, but she didn't sort of strike any new ground in terms of trying to move ahead with impeachment. So as of now, it doesn't seem like the ball has really moved that much in terms of what Congress is going to do.
Sean, you were making the point that you heard Mueller saying that there was not evidence of conspiring with Russians attempting to influence the election at the level that there was any criminal activity by the Trump administration or Trump campaign, I should say. It isn't so possible, though, that the Judiciary Committee or intelligence could choose to look at that issue to determine if it still rises to the level of an impeachable offense, even if it's not criminal.
Of course. That's what the Constitution says. When people say that Donald Trump is not above the law, he's, you know, should be held accountable. He is. But the law says for the president of the United States and the president of the United States only, your accountability is to Congress. And you can factor in a whole host of issues with regards to impeachment. And impeachment goes to suitability in the office, not just whether you committed a crime or not a crime. So, high crimes and misdemeanors, what does that mean? So, sure, I think they could toss that all into the bag, and then possibly get the equivalent of a congressional indictment, and then toss it over to the Senate. And right now, based on the Senate composition, I don't see there's a conviction. So, you know, if I were sitting there and I were in the Democratic Congressional Caucus in their senior staff meetings, what I would tell them is, you know, you can keep a low boil on with this impeachment stuff because there's certain people in the Democratic Party who are just, you know, lathering over this. But what I would do is I would continue the investigations into Deutsche Bank. I would continue the investigations into the Trump taxes. I would continue the investigations into the Clean Water Act and into fair housing and a whole host of other issues and be acidic to the Trump administration and try and counter the fact that Trump's got a pretty darn good economy. And then going into the 2020 election, make the case through investigations, because they do control the House, that he is not suitable for a second term of office, and the rest of these Republicans that supported him aren't suitable as well, and try and take back the Congress. That would be my political strategy for them. But I think right now they're playing a little bit into Republican hands, whether they realize it or not, by getting all wrapped around the axle solely on this impeachment issue.
What do you think, Matt? If you were advising, yeah, what would you suggest?
I do think they need one committee to start dealing with this. I understand. I think for a while it was like, let's have multiple committees looking at this and let's just kind of keep like attacking the president.
It's come from all angles.
And I think there's a political argument to be made for that. I don't know if the left of the party is going to accept enough of that. You have all the presidential candidates coming out saying we've got to impeach him now. That doesn't mean I think they should go down the road of impeachment, because I think I've always felt that that's politically really risky for them. He's not going to get removed. It's an enormously divisive maneuver. And if you do that, he's going to just claim victory. And you're essentially going to take, to me, the legs out from under all the presidential candidates, because what's going to happen is if at one point he's not convicted by the Senate, which is highly unlikely unless there's a whole new fact pattern that's going to happen, then he's going to be exonerated and your entire party is going to become the party of impeachment. And it's not going to the Democratic nominee, whenever that happens next March, April, May, is going to be left with essentially that's what it's going to have been, a resistance candidate as opposed to a kind of overall, I think, a strategic and sort of moral compass for the country. And I think you need to really lay out what your vision and your plan is. And so I've always thought impeachment is really risky, but I do think at some point Pelosi is going to have to find some way to let some of this pressure off her steam. I always thought she should have gone down more of the road of some kind of censure or something. Because whether you're going to impeach him or not, some of the stuff that Trump did clearly was wrong, both the flirting with the Russians as well as some of the obstructive behavior that he engaged in. And I wonder if there's some way to sort of thread this needle, continue the investigations, and in some way try to put the Congress on some kind of record, some kind of censure or something, saying this type of behavior is wrong. We don't expect it from the president.
And is that in their quiver that they can do that? They can censure a president?
They can do anything. They can set some kind of resolution or sense of Congress. I think that's safer, at least political ground, to say officially we feel like he's abused the power of the presidency without necessarily impeaching him. But I think they need to find something short of impeachment, because I just don't think he's going to be removed from office. And then you run the same risk that happened with Bill Clinton and the Republicans in 1998, which is they end up looking like it was just a kind of fatwa almost against, the president, and it becomes a sort of a holy war, and that backfired politically against them.
But of course, the Democrats who favor impeachment say this is not comparable to Bill Clinton,
right,
and his deception about an affair, that this is a panoply of behavior by the president,
yeah,
which offends ethical, moral, and potentially legal actions. And so their argument is it's really necessary for the House as a moral stand,
right,
to go on record that this president is unfit to hold office, even with the knowledge that the Senate is going to block that.
Well, the risk with it is that it's similar to Bill Clinton's in that the underlying crime in terms of collusion with Russia, some kind of conspiracy, wasn't proven exactly. So what you have essentially is a process crime stemming from the investigations. This is a longer kind of problem or concern that a lot of folks have had since Watergate with the independent counsel or some kind of these statutes, which is you get into this position where you sort of paralyze a presidency, but a lot of the charges that have come aren't necessarily from the underlying crimes, they're from the investigations themselves.
But many of the people, probably almost all of the people now advocating for impeachment,
yeah,
also advocated for it even before there were conclusions from the Mueller report based on other actions.
That's a political weakness, I think. If you want to make the case that Trump is unfit for office for some of the things that he's done, that's the problem I have with this is this has always been available to the Congress. This is Congress's job, and they've been waiting for someone else to do their job for them. It's Bill Barr's fault. Mueller's going to do it for us. And at the end of the day, if Congress wants to go down this road, they need to find a narrative and they need to find a lane that they think is compelling to the American people and that shows that there's some kind of high crimes and misdemeanors, whatever that means.
So you think they need to use the report or associated material as the basis for the impeachment?
I think they're going to have to, because I think they've been making the case for 2 years that he's unfit to be president. And look, they won a big political battle in 2000. 18, right? And so they're winning some of the arguments, certainly in terms of winning the House, and potentially they could win the presidency back. If they're going to go down impeachment, I think they're going to have to go down the obstruction road. I just think that's a really tough case. I mean, I don't know how many Americans are sitting at their breakfast tables being like, you know, I wonder if he obstructed justice when he said this or he sent that tweet. I just think that's going to be a high bar to convince people who are not already on board with this.
All right. So, Sean Walsh, what do you think about the single committee to deal with the allegations?
Well, it probably makes sense because I have to tell you, my observations of Congress right now look like a second-grade soccer match where, you know, the ball goes this way and the ball goes that way and the kids are running in all different directions. So were I to bring some uniformity, clarity, and organizational structure to it, I would probably do that. But again, I go back to the fact that impeachment is inherently a political process. And so there, as Matt noted, there are political gains to be had by some members of the Democratic Party. There is, I believe, potentially significant political damage to be done by going down this route. What are the Democrats going to say and do beyond if they simply want to impeach based on the Mueller report and the, you know, quote unquote, collusion with Russia and obstruction? Are they going to try and then pull in the Deutsche Bank issues? Are they going to try and pull in his taxes and say he did tax fraud? You know, are they going to put a whole basket of, you know, horribles as opposed to deplorables forward towards President Trump? And, you know, at some juncture, I do think that the public becomes a little bit numb to this issue. And again, it's an end game. So I hate to say it, but in politics, there are winners and losers. And so when Bill Clinton could not be convicted in the Senate, he was a loser because he got indicted, but he was a winner at the end of the day because he was not convicted. And so where do you go? And the people who led that fight are people that are federal judges now because they were removed from office, and one, I think, whose district encompassed KPCC's headquarters. I mean, there's a price to be paid if you do not, kill the king, so to speak. And in this case, I don't see him happening.
Matt?
Yeah, I think a lot of that's right. I will say, though, this isn't like it's good for Trump, right? I mean, there's still a lot of swirling around. And this is one of the reasons. Some of it, I think, is his own behavior and the way he kind of approaches his base in public policy. But another part of it is it isn't really good to have all these investigations going about. So the parade of horribles is kind of still a parade of horribles, right? And there still was a lot of flirting with Russia. He didn't behave well during the investigations. You have a lot of bank and tax questions around him. Now, the question is that enough to beat him? A lot of the kind of hysteria around him was not enough in 2016. Now, was that just because Hillary Clinton was anathema to a lot of voters and that opened the door for Trump and a more acceptable candidate, if that happens in 2020, will make it more likely they beat him? But it isn't like this is good for him. He is going to have to continue to deal with this, and he's got a very good economy. He's got a few different issues that he's trying to push out there, and that's going to have trouble getting traction. Now, I tend to think he does well kind of fighting in the mud. This is kind of naturally who he is as a kind of WWE wrestler type of person, but it isn't like on a normal level, you don't kind of want 27,000 investigations being aimed at you all the time. So it's not like this is a good thing for him. I don't want to leave with that impression either.
Matt, thank you so much. Sean, appreciate it as always. Good to have you with us. And our thanks to Wall Street Journal reporter Aruna Viswanatha joining us to talk about the Justice Department announcement this morning by Robert Mueller, the former special counsel. Matt Rodriguez, Democratic strategist. Sean Walsh, Republican strategist. Coming up, the continuing impasse over how to deal with Orange County's population of homeless residents. Right now in the city of San Clemente, there's a battle over a new location for homeless residents moved directly off of North Beach into a storage facility, a storage yard in the city. We'll talk about that as well as some of the other legal challenges there. Now time for a live update from Hedy Lynn Hurdies. Great to have you with us on Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Coming up in our second hour, the cult of authenticity in restaurants. What does that really mean? If you have a restaurant that's supposedly authentic Mexican, does it have to have certain attributes that prove its authenticity? And why is that held up as a higher standard than some sort of a fusion that's created right here in Southern California? We'll talk about that in the next hour. But first, Orange County and its homeless population are focus. Several cities within Orange County have actions against them, challenging them to provide adequate support services and housing for the homeless population. That suit was filed back in February. And the judge that's presiding over that is U.S. District Judge David Carter. Now a lawsuit has been filed by the cities of Aliso Viejo, San Juan Capistrano, and San Clemente, arguing that the judge should recuse himself in this case. As for why, with us KPCC Orange County reporter Jill Replogle. Jill, good to have you with us this morning.
Great to be here, Larry.
So what is at the heart of this move by the cities aimed at Judge Carter?
Well, Judge Carter has presided over a separate case for the past year or so, a little bit over a year, that was filed against the County of Orange and several cities in the central part of Orange County over a very similar issue, over the treatment of people living on the streets and their right to sleep in public places if there isn't appropriate shelter for them. And so essentially, these cities in South Orange County are arguing that Judge Carter is biased and that he has already come up with a foregone conclusion for how he wants the case against those cities to happen, because he has sort of brokered this or attempted to broker a countywide solution where he's been pressuring very hard for cities to open homeless shelters so that they're allowed to enforce laws against people sleeping in public places.
And specifically, what are the cities saying about Judge Carter that they are labeling as advocacy as opposed to him trying to solve the impasse and the problem?
Well, one of their arguments is that he has done a lot of personal fact-finding and met with a lot of local officials and homeless service providers and various people outside of the courtroom and without lawyers from both sides, you know, present, and without these new lawyers who are defending the cities in South Orange County present. So they're saying that they have not been privy to the kind of information, so they therefore can't combat whatever he is hearing and learning from these people. And, you know, Judge Carter he goes to homeless encampments at the crack of dawn in the middle of night. He has been to numerous shelters. He has done a ton of fact-finding on his own, and that's part of what they object to.
I've visited North Beach in San Clemente, where up until a few days ago, there were a number of homeless people that were living there, essentially camping or living in vehicles. So I got a chance to see what was happening there. Then last Friday, San Clemente moved those individuals out of the North Beach parking lot to a storage facility parking lot, I guess a couple blocks away, pretty close, just the other side of Coast Highway. Do you have an update for us on what happened with that and how the city was legally able to do that?
Right. So the city passed an urgency ordinance last week designating this site as the one and only place where people could legally camp in the city. And, you know, their intention is to try to get out from any kind of legal challenge to them being able to kick people out of the North Beach train station or other parts of the city where people are camping. And I think we're going to hear from one of the lawyers for homeless plaintiffs saying, no, that's not sufficient. You need to have a shelter, but we'll see what happens with that. So the last update that I got, which was yesterday, there's about 20 to 30 people staying there. The Sheriff's Department is not allowing people to put up tents or shelter around the city and other parts, but they can't ticket people for just sleeping on the ground, because there's a federal court precedent from last year, and it was upheld earlier this year, saying that cities can't criminalize people for sleeping outside if there is not adequate shelter for them.
We're talking with KPCC Orange County reporter Jill Replogle, who's been very closely following the ongoing legal contention between several Orange County cities, the County of Orange, and advocates for Orange County's homeless residents. Also with us is civil rights attorney Carol Sobel, who represents the homeless advocacy groups who've filed motions against the five Orange County cities. Carol, good to have you with us again.
Good to be with you.
So what are you seeing any progress in these cities creating facilities for their homeless residents?
Are you talking about the South County cities?
Yeah, the South County ones.
No, none at all. In fact, they've taken just the opposite position. They've taken the position that they will provide no shelters. And they basically, San Clemente is a really good example. San Clemente was sued by the Emergency Shelter Coalition 5 years ago for failure to comply with state law that mandates that every government entity in the state has to provide locations where shelters can be created as of right. Otherwise, you don't get to build in your city. You don't get, your general plan doesn't get approved, and you can't build high rises and business buildings and all the rest of that. So, San Clemente totally failed to identify any location. They got sued. They then identified locations that are not practicable. And so, this is why we're here. At the last city council meeting where they passed this urgent ordinance, San Clemente was adamant they would never create any shelter space in their city. That violates state law, and I think it puts them at risk of further litigation. I want to say one thing. You know, we have opposed the motion to recuse Judge Carter. He is an active judge. He is always an active judge. Everybody who appears before him knows that. You know, one of the things they complained about is that he holds court at all hours. When I first got assigned to Judge Carter, I looked up to see what he was like. And those were all the stories that Judge Carter would say to counsel, if I'm working weekends, you're working weekends. And he would have the court open on Sundays and on Saturdays. So in there, we opposed the recusal, and in their reply, the counsel for the cities criticized us for working over a holiday weekend to file our opposition.
I just want to mention that we reached out to Jones Day, the firm representing San Clemente, San Juan Capistrano, and Aliso Viejo in that motion to have Judge Carter recused from being the presiding judge, but they did not have anyone available to join us today. We've also reached out to council members and mayors of the cities that are involved. We're talking with civil rights attorney Carol Sobel, who represents the homeless advocacy groups who've filed the motions against the South Orange County cities, saying that they legally must create these shelter facilities for their residents who are unhoused. Also with us is Lori Levinson, Loyola Law professor, former federal prosecutor. Professor, good to have you with us. How rare is it or routine to ask that a federal judge recuse himself from a case like this because of advocacy, not conflict of interest?
Oh, it's fairly rare, but it may be rare to have judges, as Carol Sobel said, like Judge Carter, because he is somebody who really dives into the case and does everything he can, if he is allowed to resolve the matter. So this isn't a judge just sitting on a bench and deciding motions as they come before him. He's actually out there with the consent of the parties doing some investigation and discussions to help lead to a decision, which is totally proper. I don't even think that this motion challenges that. What they're worried about in this motion is when he's doing that in that case, will he force a decision in their case? And they can raise the issue. I don't know that they've raised enough here to actually win on the issue, but they're just sort of saying we're nervous about the discussions he's had that we haven't been privy to.
Could part of this be a strategy on the law firms and the city's part to sort of just back the judge down a little bit to try and encourage him not to go the same route that he went with trying to reach resolution in the North County cities?
Well, it could be, but they picked the wrong judge, in my opinion, to try to push against. I think it's more them saying, we're not going to have this type of mediation or settlement. We're going to fight these issues. At least that's their posture now. But, you know, who knows what other type of messaging they're trying to send the judge. I think the judge is going to decide this on whether or not he's had ex-party communications that could influence the decision, whether he feels like he can't be fair in the subsequent case. We need to know more of the details of what they're worried about.
Love to hear from residents of the South Orange County cities involved. Well, I look forward to hearing from you if you're a resident of San Juan Capistrano, of San Clemente, of Aliso Viejo, and you want to share your thoughts about how your city is dealing with its homeless population, we're at 866-893-KPCC, 866-893-5722, or the Air Talk page, kpcc.org. We'll be back in just 1 minute. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. Coming up next hour, there are several bills in Sacramento which would curtail the expansion of charter schools. The bills being carried at the behest of California Teachers Association, the union representing teachers here. And on the other side are charter school advocates who don't want to see the pace of new charters slowed. We'll talk about those bills coming up next hour. It's Air Talk right here on KPCC. But right now, our focus is on South Orange County, where three cities are involved in a legal dispute over the creation of housing or shelters for its homeless population, the cities of San Juan Capistrano, San Clemente, and Aliso Viejo. And again, if you're a resident of one of those cities, I welcome your thoughts on what you see your city attempting to do or not do. You can critique or praise your city however you see them handling this issue. 866-893-5722 or the Air Talk page, kpcc.org. Civil rights attorney Carol Sobel, I want to go back to you about San Clemente specifically, because for the individuals that were living in the train station parking lot at North Beach and have now been moved to that utility yard that's owned by the city, is that an acceptable move in your view that the city undertook?
So that everybody understands this, the particular lot in question, the only piece of property in the entire city, about a third of an acre, that the city felt was appropriate for people to put up tents on, has three times been rejected as habitable by humans. It and has even been rejected as habitable by animals. It was the original site of the animal shelter in San Clemente. The animal shelter was largely damaged by a landslide. The ground there is unstable. And the city elected not to rebuild the animal shelter there 25 years ago because of the geological hazards that are there. The city has twice tried to place the shelter, the emergency shelter there, and the Planning Commission has overridden them because it is not safe for people to be living on that piece of property. So why it is the only place in the city now that people can be is sort of beyond us. You cannot say to people who are unsheltered, you either go to a place that we have repeatedly determined has hazards, threats of landslides, earthquakes, and floods. You either go there with no shade, and there's absolutely no shade there, two porta potties, that's it, or you go to jail.
And the city can't mitigate that at all. There's no way to put up some sort of pavilion, something to keep people safe from the sun. And is the threat of landslide really the sort of imminent, or is this more you wouldn't put a building there because in the long term a creeping landslide would undermine it as opposed to come down and bury people?
Well, here's the thing. If a landslide would damage a building, it would come down and bury people, okay? I mean, because you don't have the protection of the building at that point. You're just out there in the elements. City doesn't want to spend any money on this. There are lots of other problems, and we are moving to challenge this. But let me add one thing for you,
yeah,
listeners. I think it's really critically important. The reason why Jones Day won't come on today, probably, is because we are moving to disqualify Jones Day as counsel in this case. We're filing this morning. We've already given them notice. Jones Day represented our clients in prior litigation where they were on the other side of the homelessness question in Orange County.
So you're saying it's a conflict for them essentially to switch sides?
Whoa, a conflict would be an understatement. It's the understatement of the year.
Professor Lori Levinson, is that typically cause for disqualifying a law firm's involvement in a case?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's hard to believe that they would ignore that if in case that's the case. You know, we have strict rules on conflict of interest, so this will be a very important motion for the court to decide. I don't know what their explanation might be, but ordinarily you're not allowed to be on the opposite sides of cases. You pick which side you're on and you zealously represent a client.
So let's say hypothetically Jones Day might argue, well, there was other legal action involving other homeless individuals, other cities. Therefore, we can represent the cities on this side. But I suppose the counterargument to that would be, in representing homeless advocacy groups, you had access to all kinds of privileged information with the client there that could now potentially be used against those organizations.
Larry, that's exactly right. There's two duties that a lawyer has. One is the duty of loyalty, but even if you'd say, look, that was a limited representation, there's the duty of confidentiality, and that lasts forever. So if, in fact, the firm had access to confidential information that would now be used against the client this time, they would most likely be disqualified from the case.
Jill Rep, local KPCC Orange County reporter, also with us. Jill, I don't know if that was the first time that you'd heard about that filing or if you knew that was coming against Jones Day. But if so, have the cities responded to that, to your knowledge?
Not that I'm aware of. One of Carol's partners did tell me that yesterday, and I was waiting for them to actually file. But I'm not aware what the city's response is.
All right. So we'll see. Carol Sobel, if it was determined that Jones Day could not represent the city, then they just have to go out and hire another firm to do it?
Well, I guess they have to hire a firm, but here's the other problem. The contract city attorney for the three defendant cities has shared that information with Jones Day, or Jones Day has shared information with them and strategy. I think they're all conflicted out, too.
So you think even the contracted attorneys, so these would be what, non-full-time city attorneys working on behalf of those communities?
The law firm of Best, Best and Krieger, which represents a lot of cities in Orange County.
Okay, so that would then force to another firm potentially.
Potentially.
All right.
One quick comment. The cases in which Jones Day was engaged with our clients on the homelessness litigation in Orange County are still ongoing.
All right. So those are still ongoing. So are you still using Jones Day then? Is that?
I'm not using Jones Day at all.
Okay.
They did not appear as counsel. They were involved for about 6 months. They were in, and Jill will recall the events. They were in the riverbed before when enforcement started in September of 2017. They were engaged for approximately 6 months. They participated in meetings with other counsel. They participated in strategy on a wide variety of issues. They were everywhere for 6 months.
All right. Back to you, Lori Levinson, on this. So in a case like this, where you've got these counterclaims about representation, this may take some time to resolve, I would think.
Well, it really depends. I mean, right now we've had some general allegations that there were ex parte contacts and independent investigation, but there's not a lot of facts to support it. So it could take time, but I'm sure that there's going to be an effort by Judge Carter, as he does with all things, to get it resolved sooner rather than later.
All right. I want to thank you all very much. That's Loyola Law Professor Lori Levinson, Carol Sobel, civil rights attorney representing homeless advocacy groups in the South Orange County and the cities involved there that have been sued, and Jill Rep, local KPCC Orange County reporter. You can read her work in LAist.com as well as hear her on 89.3. Coming up in the second hour, we'll talk about what authentic food means.
Morning. Special Counsel Mueller reaffirmed.
You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. We take you to a live news conference. House Judiciary Committee Chairman Jerry Nadler responding to this morning's comments by Robert Mueller.
Him repeatedly welcomed Russia's support, and that throughout the subsequent investigation, Trump sought to obstruct Mueller time and time again. Special Counsel Mueller today repeated three central points, which are critical for the American people. One, the special counsel did not exonerate the President of the United States of obstruction of justice. Two, obstruction of justice of which Special Counsel Mueller found substantial evidence, is a serious crime that strikes at the core of our justice system. 3, the Constitution points to Congress to take action to hold the President accountable for his misconduct. Unfortunately, Special Counsel Mueller was unable to pursue criminal charges against the President because Department of Justice policy prevents a sitting president from being prosecuted. That policy, in my opinion, is wrong, but it prevented the special counsel from pursuing justice to the fullest extent possible. Therefore, as Mueller again highlighted this morning, it falls to Congress to respond to the crimes, lies, and other wrongdoing of President Trump. We will do so. Make no mistake, no one, not even the President of the United States, is above the law.
Congressman, will you move then forward with impeachment proceedings? And given what Mueller has said, meaning that he feels as though the report says all that he needs to say, will you then subpoena him to testify in front of Congress?
With respect to impeachment question, at this point, all options are on the table, and nothing should be ruled out. What Special Counsel Mueller said loud and clear today for the American people is that President Trump is lying when he says no collusion, no obstruction, and that he was exonerated. If Mueller wanted to exonerate the president from having committed the crime, he would have said so. Instead, and he says he would have said so. Instead, the special counsel makes clear that obstruction of justice, which he found substantial evidence of, is a serious crime that strikes at the core of our justice system, and that the Constitution points to Congress to take action to hold the president accountable. That's exactly what we will do. The president's response to repeatedly lie to the American people and ignore all congressional subpoenas is immoral and unlawful. No one is above the law, and we will hold the president accountable.
So if I may follow up with that then, Congressman, with regards to impeachment, will you then move forward at a particular time? You say it's on the table, but what exactly does that mean specifically?
We are following through in our investigation. We will continue to do so. And we'll make decisions as they seem indicated.
And one more question. Will you subpoena Mueller to testify then?
Mr. Mueller told us a lot of what we need to hear today. It's very important to be clear on what he told us, on what the special prosecutor told the American people. He reaffirmed what was in the investigation, which was in the report about the investigation, which found substantial evidence that Russia attacked our political system, that the Trump campaign benefited from Russia's interference, that Trump and those around him repeatedly welcomed Russia's support, and that throughout the investigation, Trump sought to obstruct justice and undermine Mueller and the investigation over and over again. The special counsel did not exonerate the president from having committed a crime. DOJ policy prevented Mueller from bringing criminal charges against the president. So the president is lying about the special counsel's findings, lying and saying that the special counsel found no obstruction and no conclusion. And I should add, the attorney general is lying about that, too. That is serious, and we will take action to hold the president accountable for his misconduct. Again, I'll repeat, no one, not even the president, is above the law. Thank you very much.
Those are comments of Congressman Jerry Nadler of New York, who chairs the House Judiciary Committee. The congressman responding to comments after 2 years made by Robert Mueller this morning, 8 o'clock Pacific time, in which he characterized what his office's report was about and that was all he hoped to have to say regarding the Mueller report. Now, interestingly, Nadler's news conference, I've never seen this before. When he was responding to reporters' questions, he was pulling out a sheet and reading from it. If it sounded like he was reading, it was because he was. And, of course, people read from prepared statements starting news conferences all the time. I don't recall seeing someone read the answers to reporters' questions. He also didn't respond to the question of whether he would still subpoena subpoena Robert Mueller to testify before the committee, despite the fact that the former special counsel said everything that he would say is included in the report. He would have nothing to add to it and hoped that these would be his final comments about the investigation. So that's where we stand in terms of Congress picking up and continuing. Great to have you with us on Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Coming up a little bit later, we'll talk about the notion of authentic ethnic food. What does that mean, and what often is code embedded in that term, authentic? But first, in Sacramento, a series of bills that seek to curtail the expansion of charter schools in California. Those are public schools independently operated from local school districts that get tax dollars in support. Teachers' unions have been pushing back against the creation of charters, particularly in the massive LA Unified, which has been at the forefront of allowing the creation of charter schools. KPCC education reporter Kyle Stokes is with us. Kyle, good morning. What do these various bills do?
Yeah, good morning, Larry. So in sum, these bills have the potential to really limit the ability of charter schools to grow as fast as they had been growing, particularly in the last decade, although that growth has slowed to an extent over the most recent years. But they're still, we're now talking about 1 in 10 students in California public in California's public education system now go to charter schools. And these four different bills would do in each their own different way, kind of put a check on charter growth. There are two bills that have already passed through the one house and are on their way to the other. So these are two assembly bills. One that would sort of closes, this is sort of the quote unquote the easy one that prevents, that closes a loophole that allowed essentially allowed school districts to authorize charter schools in someone else's school district, across school district lines. Remember that a charter, the thing that makes a charter school different from any other public school is that it has to get the permission of an authorizer like a school district or the county office of education or state board of education that basically gives them permission to open the school in the first place. And then a nonprofit organization opens that school and runs that school now.
Just to clarify, you're saying that districts have been authorizing charter schools in other districts?
That's right. And in fact, L.A. County has been sort of the sort of hotbed for this. Hotbed is sort of a relative term here. It is one of the places where this is this infrequently used exemption in the law has been used most often. And it goes back to the Acton Agua Dulce School District, which has chartered several charter schools outside of its own limits. And this has been the subject of some litigation in the past as well.
So have the other districts sued about Acton Agua Dulce opening these?
This bill now sort of closes that loophole and makes it much, much more difficult to authorize a school across the district lines. Another bill that just passed narrowly through the assembly also deals with this process of authorizing, the idea that a nonprofit group goes to a school district and says, please allow us to open a charter school. Current law makes it, I guess supporters of this legislation would say, current law makes it very difficult for a school district to say no to a petitioner who's hoping to open
a charter
school.
So the default is approval.
I wouldn't say that the default is approval, but you can't deny a charter school if you're concerned about the effect of that charter school on the district's finances. Or another example that's been cited
often. Yeah, because who would ever charter a charter if that was, they'd never allow it to open because of course it's going to affect finances.
Precisely right. And we'll get to that thought in just a second. But other things that you can't deny it for are, there are already 8 charter schools on this city block or something like that, or within this very small area. AB 1505, which passed last week, would make it a little bit easier for districts to say no. In fact, it would make it a lot easier for districts to say no to people who are trying to charter schools if a charter school were to have a negative financial impact or it would have a negative academic impact.
Well, that's so easy to claim or it even prove in terms of dollars, because, of course, it will take. I mean, that sounds like a de facto ability to ban charters.
To pick up your point that you were saying, this is absolutely being read as by charter school supporters as and as a blatant, you know, a frontal assault on charter schools, and that's how they would frame this. Now, I think that, you know, if you talk to supporters, obviously they would, you know, there's certain people who would prefer that charter schools go away entirely. But I think even if you talk to some people who are trying to be a little bit more nuanced about this, charter schools do not. There's not a lot of. You know, they would argue that school districts need to have this ability to say, we're already doing this in our district. We need to make sure that the portfolio of options that we are offering to parents within our school district serves a variety of different needs. And if a charter school is just going to come into the same neighborhood and offer to do the same thing that other local school districts or local schools are doing that are run by the district, say there's a charter that wants to come in and run dual language programs when there are already three dual language programs in the neighborhood, that sort of raises a question of whether that charter is adding value, which is what the original idea of the charter school model was to be.
Well, but part of, as I understood, part of the charter school model, I mean, there are a number of things it was intended to do. One is to pilot and experiment and do things to see that might be harder for districts in their bureaucratic way to try.
Right.
The other thing is the idea of parental option. So let's say you've got three Spanish language immersion schools that were within 5 square miles or 7 square miles. And the charter wants to open one. The idea was, well, the charter's got to compete with the district-operated one. Let's see which one parents gravitate toward that they feel does the best job in Spanish immersion. So part of it was the idea of providing a competition for the monopoly of the district-run school.
Right. And I think that to a large extent, school choice is already a huge part of what's going on, for instance, in Los Angeles. You know, if you take charter schools out of the equation, parents are still making a lot of choices. I believe that something like half of the school district's students made some kind of a choice about where they were going to school, or their parents did, whether to a magnet school, these dual language options, open enrollment, where you just pick another school in another neighborhood, and if they have space, you can transfer into that school. There are permits where you can go from, you know, one area to the other, desegregation-related activity.
Magnet schools.
And the magnet schools, as I mentioned. So, I mean, there's already a lot of choice. Charters add to that. And I think that the question here that a person who would be in favor of restricting charter school growth a little bit more is whether or not LA or other, you know, districts where there are a lot of charter schools have reached a point of saturation where there are perhaps too many charter schools. I think they would say that they're starting to eat into the very, you know, kind of cut through the fat of the school districts and now hit bone, that you're talking about charters. When you add more charter schools to the equation, you're doing material harm to the school district, not only financially, but academically, where you're kind of dividing things up into too many different competing forces. I think there's a general questioning of that framing of whether a choice-based education system is good for overall education of all students.
So there's a theory that there's such a thing as too much choice.
And too much competition. And I think that this is sort of a difficult thing to talk about, because even if you took charters off of the table, like I mentioned, there'd still be a lot of choice in LA. I think the issue is that the district can regulate the kinds of portfolio options it has. I mean, LA Unified has, you know, 800, 900 campuses, but it's able to decide, you know, if we've already got a dual language program in this area that's going to serve students who feed into such and such middle school and such high school, they can decide, well, we're not going to authorize another dual language program. The way the current charter law is written doesn't allow the district to step in and say, whoa, what are you adding to the equation here?
Kyle Stokes, KPCC education reporter, is with us. I'd like to hear from you what you think about these bills in Sacramento, which would curtail the growth of charter schools. At least that is the intended purpose of the bills. Kyle describing what they would do. We're hearing the pros and cons from both the charter school advocate position as well as the district and teacher advocacy position. We're at 866-893-KPECC, 866-893-5722, or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. It's a chance for you to weigh in while these bills are still under consideration. We'll be back in just 1 minute. The future of charter school growth in California, that's our focus. KPCC education reporter Kyle Stokes is with us, and I'd like to hear what you think about these bills. We're at 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Kyle talking with us about the four bills currently in Sacramento being debated that are sponsored by the California Teachers Association, which wants to cut down on the growth of charter schools, which over the past 10 to 20 years have grown dramatically, particularly in the LA Unified School District, where there's been a huge growth in charter schools. One of them that Kyle talked about would stop districts from authorizing charter schools outside of their own district. Another one, the second one, Kyle, that you mentioned had to do with the authorization, if it would have financial or curriculum implications for the schools, the district could block
it. The shorthand, it's easier to say no to a charter that wants to open.
And then the third would involve a cap. What level is that cap at?
Right. So this is AB 1506, and it is currently on the assembly floor, so it hasn't yet passed through that body, and there's sort of a deadline looming at the end of this week. The idea of AB 1506 is that it would enact a cap starting in January of 2020 that would say that if a school district's student enrollment was at 10% or more of charter school enrollment, that no more charters could be authorized within that district. And that, again, that would start in January of 2020. Now, there has been some question about, we sort of thought maybe this bill was going to move last week before the Memorial Day holiday, and now here we are this week. There's some question about whether it's actually going to move forward at this point. I think there's some concern among supporters that it's not going to move forward at this point, that maybe it doesn't have the votes. Like I say, we're going to know by Friday because there is a legislative deadline for bills to clear through from one house to the other. But there is that cap that is at least being talked about right now in the assembly floor.
Well, it's interesting because I'm sure from the charter school proponent point of view, it's like, yeah, it's like, don't be too successful. If we're getting 10%, have a risk of getting 20 or 30. You know, we can't allow that to happen because charters can't be that successful in drawing parents. I'm sure that's, and from the teacher's perspective, the district perspective is the loss of revenue, I'm sure, for them going beyond 10%. Gets into, as you put it, the meat and bone of the district.
Yeah, the argument often goes that charter schools cut into the ability of districts are not able to, when they lose a student, you lose a certain amount of revenue. And when you lose that amount of revenue, it doesn't mean if you've got a school with 100 students in it, and then one of them goes to the charter school, it isn't that much cheaper to operate a school for 99 kids than it is for 100. Taking 25 kids out of a teacher's class and turning it to 24, you can't hire one fewer teacher. And so that's the sort of argument about what charter schools, you know, how that can be especially detrimental to school districts because it leaves them with the same facilities costs, the same overhead costs, but not the ability to scale down at, you know, in proportion to the amount of enrollment.
Well, an LA Unified would be undergoing declining enrollment anyway, even if there weren't charters, just because the cost of living in Los Angeles has led to the flight of many families.
Right. And to that point, what charter school supporters would say is that, and we're talking about sort of a well-known debate at this point, but just to make that point, that charter school supporters would say, if this enrollment decline has been happening in Los Angeles Unified for this long, that the district should have been making more efforts to scale back commensurate to the amount of enrollment that they're doing. And they would argue, the charter supporters would argue, that those sorts of changes and, you know, quote-unquote right-sizing hasn't been happening.
Elizabeth in Encino, good to have you with us. What do you think about these bills that would curtail the growth of charters?
I think it's a dangerous way to go because I think what you're seeing is that we're all just fighting for the scraps of funding for LAUSD. My son was at LAUSD for kindergarten and first, and he is not a visual learner. And we tried a couple of different LAUSD schools. They both were highly tested, and he was coming home with big zeros on his pages every day and feeling like he was stupid. He would come home and say,
Elizabeth, I'm sorry to interrupt, but we have limited time. So you have your son in a charter now?
Decided to go 25 miles up to Santa Clarita to find a project-based learning program. And you say there's a lot of variety and choice in LAUSD, but they are all the same system. And a lot of kids do not thrive in the style of teaching that LAUSD does.
So you're saying this charter that you drive 25 miles round way, round trip from the West Valley to Santa Clarita has a different system that connects with your son?
Yes, it's project-based, it's kinetic, and it's just an amazing program for kids that aren't successful at LAUSD.
Elizabeth, I appreciate it very much. So, Kyle, an example there of a parent saying, I can't get that, despite LA Unified's schools and the different programs they offer.
Yeah, and that's the difficulty here. I mean, we're talking about parents who are choosing charters, you know, clearly about almost 20% of the LA Unified School District's student enrollment is now in an independent charter, and they've done that because they feel like the district system, you know, a lot of them have done it because they feel like the district system may not be a fit for them. There are others who are probably doing it for less, you know, kind of maybe perhaps for reasons of convenience, we don't know, but we're talking about choice here. This is a, we have a school system that values in LAUSD that values choice in a lot of different ways. And I think the question is how much choice is enough choice? And I think that these bills are aimed at setting in limits to try and change the current balance in that equation.
Tria in Koreatown says, I have two kids. One is in a district school, one's in a charter. My district daughter is in special education, which is completely left out of the charter. I wish charters had more options for special ed. On top of that, when you take kids out of district schools and put them into charters, it takes money away from public schools. They need the extra support for special education classes. Let's talk with Lenny in the Miracle Mile District. You're on Air Talk.
Yes, thanks for taking the call. In 2009, Stanford did a study in its Center for Research and Education Outcomes. And what they discovered is that charters, 17% of them do better, 46% do exactly the same, and 37% do worse. So the whole notion, charters are nonprofits in name only. They are for-profit corporations that are, they're run and owned by for-profit corporations that charge two and three times market value for all their goods and services. It's a scam.
What, okay, I'm a little confused. They charge, who are they charging two to three times?
They charge the nonprofit charter that needs to have a building, needs to buy books. LAUSD has the same issue with what are called agreed upon vendors. Under the notion of economics of scale, something larger should get a better price when you buy more. They don't get a better price, Larry. You can go into Fry's Electronics and buy a laptop computer for $500 less than what the district spends. And the same scam is going on in charter schools.
Okay. And you say they're nonprofit in name only. So you're saying that they're paying more, but their margin is higher than a district school? That seems to contradict.
More because all their contracts are negotiated for by a for-profit corporation. Education in the United States is a $1.3 trillion a year business. And if corporations can privatize it by putting up a false nonprofit like a charter and then getting all of the goods and services it produces going to corporations that are owned, for-profit corporations.
Okay, boy, Lenny, you're talking about a very sophisticated, multi-level sort of a scam,
well,
Kyle.
Well, let's pick a couple things apart there. There are important points. One is the idea that there are some that do better, 46% that are the same, 37% do worse. It is absolutely true that charter performance is no better than district school performance. The other thing is that there are, you know, when he says
those are averages, that's important.
On average, you know, there are people who would argue that LAUSD, that charters in LAUSD do better than LAUSD. Well, if you start breaking out the magnet school results in LAUSD, the magnets tend to perform better than the charter schools do. So there's a lot to break down there in terms of the performance. I think the point to what these bills are talking about is not just the same in terms of performance. Jackie Goldberg, the new LAUSD school board member, says, you know, I've been in, you know, has had experience in 3 or 4 dozen charter schools over the last couple of years, has had some up close in person knowledge with that, with running teacher training programs or being involved with those, and saying there, you know, half of these schools in the district that look exactly the same as other district options. What AB 1505 would do, if it is ultimately approved, would make it so the district could say, we're not going to allow these charters that are coming in and doing the exact same thing from continuing to proliferate. One other point about the for-profit issue, and definitely this is one of the big concerns about charter schools, and it has been in the past. California recently passed legislation that banned for-profit corporations from being involved in the operation of charter schools. They were not explicitly forbidden before. They were a minority of the number of charter operators, but they did some of, I mean, there were a lot of concerns. The attorney general got involved with one of the operators, K-12 Inc., that was running a virtual charter school. In any case, the legislature banned for-profit corporations from running charters.
From setting up nonprofits to run charters.
Well,
what Lenny
setting
is
up
describing.
Some sort of a pass-through
organization. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, what Lenny's
and
describing is a nonprofit.
The law specifically forbids pass-through of money to for-profit corporations. There's still concern that corporations are going to be able to reorganize themselves so that they can become nonprofits and still be able to profit, as you know, critics you know talk about. But California has taken steps to limit this small minority of for-profit operators from continuing to operate.
Let me share another comment. Lauren in La Cunada, our school district is fabulous, but made it clear unions are primarily interested in their own jobs. For teachers to oppose school choice is understandably motivated by job protection, but I don't think charters should be limited. That's Lauren in La Cunada. We're at 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Gregory in Redondo Beach, what do you think of these 4 Sacramento bills that would curtail the growth of charters?
Thanks, Larry, for taking my call. I think they're really bad ideas. You know, we have a lack of great schools in Los Angeles. We need more great charter schools. We need more great magnet schools. And to put a cap on where parents can actually send their children, and I disagree with, you know, a number of things that have been said. We know that on average, charter schools actually perform better than district schools, particularly, Kyle, when you look at the A through G requirements. Who's preparing children to be able to go to college, particularly low-income children and children of color? It's charter schools. It's not district schools. But overall, just capping the number of schools that are available, particularly high-quality schools for parents, today just doesn't make any sense. We need more great schools, not fewer. And these bills will lead to the closure of great schools and neighborhoods and force parents to send their kids back to schools that are not performing.
And we should just mention, no schools would be closed by these bills, right, Kyle? This has to do with creation of new schools.
That's my understanding, is that they would prevent there are some cases in which it would prevent schools from getting the permission they need to continue to stay.
Oh, so it could actually close currently open schools that the district said,
that's the fear. I mean, because the reauthorizing changes that would be made under AB 1505, if it ultimately is passed and signed into law, would make it so that every time a charter comes forward to renewal, you know, the president of the California Charter Schools Association has said to me, it's not hard to envision a situation where 20% of the charter school portfolio in California is seeing closure every year. And perhaps that's a bit of an overstatement, but there's certainly a large level of existential risk to even existing charters that would have to go through a much tougher process of renewal going forward.
All right. Allie in Windsor Square in L.A. says, I'm on the board of a charter. The thing that is that's not included in this conversation is that UTLA has a stranglehold on the district. It's halting reform. We can't take away choices like charters until we can reform the district. That's Allie in Windsor Square. You can share your comments on the AirTalk page, kpcc.org. Kyle, thanks so much. I appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Kyle Stokes with us to talk about these 4 bills in Sacramento, which I was mischaracterizing by saying they would just curtail charters, might actually end up, curtail the growth, might actually end up with charters closing at the time of reauthorization. Coming up, we'll talk about the notion of authentic ethnic cuisine. What's really meant by that? And is that even an important notion? We'll be back right after a live update from Hetty Lynn Hurdies. Fresh Air with Terry Gross in 20 minutes here on KPCC. And Terry talks with the writer of a modern day fairy tale, Myra Coleman, and her son Alex. Talk about their new book and exhibit about the family's matriarch, who at the age of 60 moved from the shtetl to Tel Aviv, then to New York, leaving her husband starting a new life. Plus an interview from the archives with Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and author Tony Horwitz. He was with us several times on Air Talk. He passed away a couple of days ago. He's out on his book tour for his new book, and he died suddenly, apparently, of a heart attack. Tony Horwitz, who had been with us on Air Talk several times. We're very sad to hear that he died on Monday. So from the archive, Terry talks with him coming up in a few minutes. But right now, we turn our attention to an op-ed piece from John Paul Bremer, who's a New York-based writer. He writes op-eds for The Washington Post. And he wrote one recently titled, "I'm from a Mexican Family. Stop Expecting Me to Eat, Quote, Authentic Food." And he joins us to talk about the notion of authentic food, which, you know, here in Los Angeles, I don't know if we put so much stock in authenticity because we love mashups of stuff. We love stuff that takes different cultural influences and turns it on its head. That is kind of part of the fun here, as long as it's not made more bland. John Paul, thank you for being with us.
Oh, thank you for having me. I'm super excited to be here.
Yeah, I appreciate it. So how do you define the way that people use authentic? What do they mean when they say that to you?
Yeah, so I think typically people who are looking for a quote-unquote authentic experience, it's usually from either Mexican or Chinese restaurants or people who serve non-white cuisine. What they're really looking for is sort of based on what the stereotypical perception of what food from those places is like. And they sort of want to feel like they're experiencing something that they can't get anywhere else. They don't want to be able to go right across the street for it. They want to feel like they're having something exotic, something that has a tradition behind it. So what you end up with is sort of places that really take a lot of stock about the semiotics and the aesthetics of that without really caring about whether the food is good or not. And you tend to get places that get punished for, as you said, having fun with it or playing around with cuisine.
The other aspect of it is that, you know, Mexico is a big country and you've got, you know, very high end, very elegant restaurants in Mexico and you've got, you know, tacos on the street. So how do you even determine what it really means when you're speaking the aesthetic of authenticity?
Right. I think it's really hard to, and I think it's sort of tied in with how people see Mexican people on the whole. I mean, you've probably heard it before that there's so many Americans who think that everything south of the border is just Mexican. It's like you could be from Honduras, you could be from Guatemala, you could be from Brazil even, and people will just say, oh, those are Mexicans. And so I think it's sort of based on this flattened idea of what Latin American identity even is. It's really based on some shallow, sort of incurious stereotypes. And I think that's where my biggest problem with it comes from. It's like you said, Mexico is a huge place with so many different types of people and types of cuisine, and we're definitely not a monolith.
We're talking with John Paul Bremer. He writes about food, among other things, and wrote a recent piece in The Washington Post, an op-ed. "I'm from a Mexican family. Stop expecting me to eat authentic, quote-unquote, food." Have you felt as a food writer in some ways sort of constrained, like people, because of your ethnicity, they expect you to write primarily about food from Latin America?
Oh, God, absolutely. And I mean, I wish it was just contained to food writing. It's sort of like that in every writing I do. I mean, you know, I've covered politics, I've done a lot of reporting, and typically what people want out of me is like, but what's the Mexican perspective on that? Like, aren't you angry about this thing that Trump said? You know, usually I am, but I can write about other things. I have other areas of expertise. So I think for any person who's, you know, Mexican-American or from a Latin American background, we tend to get pigeonholed and we tend to get restricted in terms of what people trust us to talk about.
And I think that's my biggest issue that I'm hitting at in the piece, is that this is such a restrictive, limiting concept, and we can go so much farther beyond it if we're allowed to.
Also with us, in addition to John Paul, is Gustavo Arellano, features writer for the Los Angeles Times, and just as importantly in this context, the author of Taco USA, How Mexican Food Conquered America. Gustavo, good morning.
Hola, Larry.
Hi. You write a lot about this notion of authenticity. And, you know, what do you think of how it's used popularly as sort of a positive or necessary quality of a restaurant?
Yeah, first of all, I love John Paul's piece. I remember when I read it, I had admired his writing for years. And then to see that talking about food, I'm like, yes. And I'm glad that the Washington Post posted about it. John, he was really focusing sort of on the American expectations of what, quote unquote, authentic Mexican food is. I always criticize more, though, the Mexican part of it. So even among us Mexicans, we have an idea of what Mexican food is. And if it doesn't match our expectations, it could be Mexicans themselves trying these new things, and they'll get criticized. Here in Southern California, of course, we have a lot of these pocho restaurants. Pocho meaning, of course, an assimilated Mexican-American. So, for instance, in Cerritos, there's a place called Amor y Tacos by Thomas Ortega, and he does this really great dish, tater tots with mole. Mole, of course, that great, wonderful...
That sounds really good.
It's delicious, but a lot of people say, oh, that's not authentic. Mexican Americans will say, that's not authentic Mexican food. My grandma didn't make it, therefore, it's not authentic. So for me, authenticity is this idea of memory. But I also argue that to try to constrain a cuisine in these shackles of authenticity, it's not good for the culture and it's not good for the food either.
Yeah, with my in-laws, I find this very interesting because they're from Mexico, but back, you know, a couple of generations. And so, yeah, there's always, you know, a pot of beans that are on the stove and traditional what you think of as you know, Mexican cuisine, but they're eating every place else that everybody else is who's Caucasian, who, you know, grows up in Southern California. So the idea that sort of that ancestral food would define them is very limiting and sort of takes the influence of L.A. out of the equation.
Oh, yeah. Like, I mean, and even on the day-to-day basis, come on, no one eats 100% purely authentic. I remember last year we had my Tio Santos' 70th birthday party out in the City of Industry. And so we had this wonderful catering. We had all these moles. We had all this beans and rice and arroz. And then on the corner was a box of Little Caesar's pizza. And we're wondering, who the hell got the Little Caesar's pizza? It turned out to be my 96-year-old grandma who said, well, this is so my grandkids or great-grandkids can eat the pizza. Well, it turned out that the pizza was the first thing to go. Everyone, even my uncles, even my cousins from Mexico, they wanted their mole, yes, but they wanted the pizza to sop up all the mole.
We're talking with Gustavo Arellano of the LA Times and author of Taco USA, How Mexican Food Conquered America, terrific book published just over 5 years ago, and writer of the Washington Post op-ed, I'm from a Mexican family, stop expecting me to eat authentic food. John Paul Bremer with us as well. I'd like to hear from you what you think of the notion of authenticity and how that's sort of held up as the epitome of great ethnic cuisine. 866-893-KPCC, 866-893-5722, or the AirTalk page, kpcc.org. I was gesticulating, held up, and Parker, our engineer, thought I was just saying, turn the music down. No, I'm just getting into it, Parker. We'll continue in 1 minute on AirTalk. A week ago Saturday, we had the memorial for my wife's grandfather, who passed away at the age of 90, grew up in Los Angeles in East L.A. His parents came from Mexico. And as we were talking about where to go out after the memorial, I said, well, you know, we can look at, you know, different Mexican restaurants where maybe go and have the, you know, the post-service lunch. And my wife said, well, he liked Mexican food, yeah, but probably, you know, something distinctly American would have been more his choice. So that's exactly what we did. We ended up going to Northwoods Inn, Clearman's, instead of to a Mexican restaurant. Just another example of, you know, when you grow up in Los Angeles, You often gravitate not just toward the food that you grew up with, but the places that are iconic sorts of LA experiences. I'd like to hear from you what the notion of authenticity means to you. 866-893-KPCC, 866-893-5722, or the AirTalk page, kpcc.org. Gustavo, I assume my Northwoods anecdote sort of rings home based on what you were just saying.
Oh, my God, yeah, the snow cabin, right?
Yeah.
By freeway. Everyone in Southern California knows it.
Yeah, no, he loved that, and so that's a choice. 866-893-KPCC. Kai, in Fullerton, I understand you're Chinese-American, so what do you think of this concept of authentic cuisine?
Hey, Larry. I've been to Beijing several times in the past few years, and the young people over there just eat fried rice with spoons. And, you know, as a Chinese-American growing up, I always thought that fried rice, you know, was, like, really Americanized, really watered-down Chinese food. But I think my point is, you know, in China, like, the concept of what authentic food is completely evolving. You know, the country is becoming so westernized and modernizing so quickly that what we think of as authentic Chinese food today in America is, like, you know, 1970s, you know, very specific kind of Cantonese food.
Yeah, and just stopped in time. Kai, that's a great point. John Paul Bremer, your thoughts on Kai's observation?
I can totally relate. I mean, it's such a relative term, isn't it? Authenticity is. I mean, being a Mexican-American, I have such a different perspective from someone who was born and raised in Mexico. I mean, I come from the world of Tex-Mex, which is often looked down on in terms of Mexican food at large because it's cheesy. You have flour tortillas, you have rice, you have beans, and that's not something that happens in the southern part of Mexico. But it still is authentic. There are still cultural influences that led to Tex-Mex being a thing, and there is such a thing as, you know, authentic Tex-Mex. And I really just think it depends on where you come from and how you look at food.
All right. Kai, I appreciate your call. Richard in Simi Valley, what does authenticity in cuisine or restaurants mean to you?
Well, I've got kind of the opposite side. So for about 9 years, I was engaged to a woman whose family deep Mexican roots. She was the first generation of her family actually born in the United States. So, and I'm total white guy. I mean, Irish, red hair, the whole nine yards. It was interesting to me when I would go to her family get-togethers and her family events, how they were not eating the foods that I was raised to believe were Mexican foods. So you're raised going to the restaurants and it's tacos, it's burritos, it's enchiladas, and then you show up to a big family party and they're frying chicken in a copper pot. They've got pasta. And it was kind of a culture shock to see, wow. So all of the time I thought that Mexicans ate rice, burritos, and beans. And there's you eat, you know, for lack of a better phrase, you eat just like me.
Yeah, Richard, did that break up the relationship?
God, no. Oh, there is nothing better than a grandmother's flan. Oh.
Richard, I appreciate it. 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Root Torpedo writes on the page, Tito's Tacos, world's least authentic Mexican food and an L.A. institution with a never-ending line. Root Torpedo, as it should be, don't say anything against Tito's Tacos. Gustavo?
But yes, they are completely authentic to a certain portion of the Mexican community. And not only that, the hard-shell tacos I talk about a lot in my book. In Mexico, we eat hard-shell tacos. They're called tacos dorados. So, again, both nowadays, what's amazing to me about the idea of authenticity, now you have, for lack of a better term, white folks telling Mexican-Americans that, say, Tex-Mex is not authentic, that Cal-Mex is not authentic. I guess that I did a big package for Eater.com about Mexican food in the United States, and there's all these traditions. In Kansas City, for instance, their version of tacos are hard-shell tacos encrusted with Parmesan cheese. It was a marriage of Mexican and Italian cultures based right there in Kansas City, and now those tacos are in danger of disappearing because people want, quote-unquote, authentic tacos, which we here in Southern California just call tacos.
Jessica in Pasadena says, I think authenticity is really about the ingredients. For me, in my heritage, homemade tortillas for Mexican food, salsa from scratch. But getting creative with those ingredients shouldn't be limited by the concept of authenticity. John Paul, what do you think?
Oh, I totally agree. And I think, you know, the tyranny of authenticity for me, it's really apart from the quality, because I think it's not a matter of, oh, it's inauthentic because it tastes bad. I think food tastes good or it tastes bad, and ingredients, fresh ingredients, are a huge part of that. I just don't see why we have to tie it to this idea of, oh, it's real or it's fake.
There's the title of your book, John Paul, The Tyranny of Authenticity.
There, we found it.
You just said it, yeah. All right, Rick. Thanks very much, Rick. I understand that you immigrated from Singapore. Is that right?
Yes.
Yeah. So is there a concept of what is authentic or not in the country you came from?
Very much so. And I'm talking basically about authenticity more now since I've been living in in California for the last 40 years. The Chinese food, and I'm speaking specifically for Chinese food, not Mexican food, a lot of the Chinese food has morphed into what the Americans like to eat and the kind of flavors they like, which is more sweet and kind of starchy, you know. So a lot, that's, I think, the kind of authenticity we should be focusing on. Food innovation is different. Every culture has food innovation. So the authenticity has disappeared from a lot of Chinese-American restaurants. What they're serving is not Chinese food. And it's different, but it's very popular. I mean, we have restaurants here in Long Beach, California, where I live, that are thriving despite, I mean, I wouldn't even step in. You couldn't even bring me there to eat for free.
But, Rick, I mean, there are whole swaths of the San Gabriel Valley with all kinds of Chinese restaurants that have regional cuisines and particular specialties that are, you know, packing the house for people who are comparatively recent arrivals from those countries. So,
right.
You know,
that's where authenticity exists and thrives in SGV, you know?
All right, Rick, I appreciate it. Let's talk next with Dan in Arcadia. Dan, you have an example related to St. Patrick's Day?
Correct, yes. My father often would be put in charge. Well, after a while, they stopped doing it at, like, a local Sons of Shillelagh Irish organizations. On St. Patrick's Day, people would expect corned beef and cabbage.
Sure.
My father insisted that corned beef and cabbage was an Irish-American tradition that was started on the East Coast. And in Ireland, they eat ham and cabbage. What would happen is he would prepare boiled ham and cabbage for a big party at a local Sons of Shillelagh or a Knights of Columbus on a St. Patrick's Day celebration. And what in turn would happen was there's just a bunch of disappointed people because he was such a nudge about being authentic.
I love it. Dan, thank you for sharing that story. Appreciate it so much. Ham and cabbage doesn't have the same ring to it, definitely. John Paul Bremer, thank you so much for being with us. Gustavo Arellano, as always, thank you. Have a great afternoon.